Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
We are hugely honoured to be with Michael Francis today. I've been following his stuff for years. I've watched his stuff. I've watched Sammy's stuff. I've watched him go ballistic on YouTube. He's going to be doing a tour of the UK. I'm going to be getting involved in the Manchester and Liverpool dates. Can't wait for that. It's going to commence in London. Early July. All the links for Michael's channel and the tour dates will be in the description box below this video. And you may have seen him on Mike Tyson's channel, you may have seen him on my friend Patrick Valuetainment's channel, and on and on and on and on it goes. Tens of millions of views. His own channel right now, he's marching towards a million. His book is out, which has got almost 1,000 reviews on Amazon UK. It's Mafia Stories, but business tips as well. So endless content you could dive into with what Michael's doing. And he's kind of like the last of a generation, really, of people from that era. You've watched these movies like The Sopranos, Goodfellas, and he has his Mob Movie Mondays where he analyzes and reviews them. And there's not many people left alive. Even when Michael was in the newspaper, of the, was it like 50 or 60, they're nearly all dead, aren't they?
48 of them are dead, out of 50. One of them is alive, but he's still in prison. And then there's me, so pretty fortunate.
Well, huge thank you for coming and, yes, and being with us today. It's actually my 20th year anniversary of my SWAT team raid from Phoenix, Arizona.
Congratulations.
I'll tell you how you recognised that on the train ticket this morning. So,
really?
Yeah, he looked down and went, yeah, it's been 20 years since my... the SWAT team, wasn't it?
SWAT team, yeah. But you stopped over in Arizona on your journey in the federal prison system.
Yes.
Could you describe what happened there?
Well, I was supposed to go, as part of my plea agreement, they were supposed to send me to Terminal Island, which is a prison near my home in California. But as usual, Bureau of Prisons, you know, well, it was too crowded in Terminal Island. It's too crowded in every federal prison. That's the excuse they used. And they sent me to Phoenix, Scottsdale, actually. It was a fairly new prison. And I was there for about 6 months. And while I was there, this whole Fortune magazine article came out. And I'll never forget, Sean, Jennifer, you'll appreciate this. This big, well, you're not from the States, but I hope you understand. This big, heavyset lieutenant calls me into his office, and he shows me the article. I didn't even know it came out, right? 50 biggest and wealthiest mob bosses in the country. And he said, "Don't you think you mafia guys are taking over my prison?" I said, "What are you talking about?" You know, he shows me the article. And I said, "Look," I said, "you can lock me in my cell. Just make sure I get my visits, as is in something to eat and a phone call, and you'll never hear from me again." So he said, "Okay," and he locked me down. And I was locked up for about 2 weeks while I did all the promotional tour on the magazine. And I stayed there for about 6 months until they finally got me to Terminal Island.
What year was that then?
That was in 1986.
So this was in Scottsdale, 1986. Yes. I think Sheriff Joe Arpaio was running the jail system.
Well, that was the state system. Yeah. I was in the federal system, yeah. So he didn't get involved in that.
So what was it like when the heat went up then? Were you housed?
It was, you mean the real heat or the, yeah, it was hot. It was 120 degrees. It was a miserable place to be in.
On the UK temperature schedule, that's almost 50 degrees.
Yeah, it was tough. And my wife was coming out every weekend with the kids to see me, you know, but she was in Scottsdale, which is beautiful. You know,
that's what my SWAT team rate was.
Yeah, you get through it, Sean. You know.
What about the coming into the cell? Was it the old swamp cooler?
No, because it was a fairly new prison. It was just built, so it had air conditioning. You know, it wasn't bad that way. But yeah, you know, after a while, they were all the same.
Yeah.
So you ranked number 18 in the magazine.
Yes.
How did you feel about that?
You know, it's never good to get that kind of high-profile publicity when you're in prison. They look at you differently as far as the guards are concerned, you know. The inmates, everybody's coming up to you with a deal. You know, Michael, listen, and you know, it's funny, Sean, you probably experienced this. all these guys come and they tell you, the next time I'm not going to make a mistake. I know exactly what I'm going to do. And I learned. And you know what my answer was? Well, who did you learn from? Everybody in here got caught. So how are they going to teach you anything new? You know, but these guys, you know, they always got a scheme or something on their head. But
so how many years total have you served in your entire life?
I did just about 8 years.
So watching your videos, and you've not really told many prison stories, like what you saw in the prisons, various prisons you were in. What kind of crazy stuff did you observe or experience?
You know what I learned in there, Sean? Everybody that never got any respect on the street wants all the respect in there. So my dad, he was a very wise guy, and he told me, he says, Michael, I'm going to give you three things that are going to help you tremendously when you go to prison. Because he knew one day I was going to go, right? I said, what's that, Dad? He said, know how to say please, thank you, and excuse me. He says, you know, you bump into somebody, excuse me. He says, somebody hands you something, you know, thank you. Do you mind if I cut in line, please, you know? And you know what? He was so right. Because I saw things happen in there when guys tried to push their weight around. People don't take it kindly in there, you know. I remember one guy getting hit over the head with a mop wringer, one of those 30-pound mop wringers, all steel, just boom, smashed his head open. I saw a lot of things in there that where guys lose control and, you know, stabbings and all that kind of stuff. It happens quite a bit.
What's the violence over predominantly? Is it drugs and debts, things like that?
Yeah, it's stupid things, you know. You don't gamble in there. I used to tell guys that came in, I says, if you gamble, you make sure you got the money to pay it. I said, because in here, you're going to pay for it. So a lot of guys over, but guys gamble in there. Stupid little gambling debts, couple of $100, boom, get stabbed or get hurt for. You know, there's things in there you just don't engage in because they're problems.
Was there any attempts on you?
Huh?
Was there any attempts on you?
No attempts on me. The only time I had a problem was an accident, actually. One of the hot points in prison are the telephones. Because everybody has a limited time on the phone. And there's a line at times, and if somebody's behind you and you're cutting into their time, that's bad. They're trying to talk to their family, their lawyer, whatever. So I'm on the phone, and I was very respectful of that because I didn't want anybody taking my time. I hang up the phone, I walk through the dorm, and somebody comes from somewhere, and boom, sideswipes me. And I was stunned for a minute. I look at him, and the guy goes, I hit the wrong guy. He hit me by mistake. It was somebody else. He was a black guy, I don't mind saying it, you know. And he got, Michael, I'm so sorry. And I said, all right, don't worry about it, I understand. But here's what happened. That night, him and his guys came to me because they figured I was going to hurt this guy. You know, he's a young guy. He's probably 23, 24. I said, there's no problem. It was an accident. I get it. He's, no, Michael, we know you guys. I said, there's no problem. But since that time happened, anything that I wanted from this crew, they got. Anything at all, you know? So, you know, but that was the only time I ever had a problem. Nothing else.
What was your favorite prison versus the worst prison you were in?
The best prison was Terminal Island.
Terminal Island.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. It was right on the water. I had a setup there like you couldn't believe, you know? It was just terrific. And it was close to my house, so my wife could come, you know, 3-4 days a week. So, and that's why, as part of my deal, I knew how, because in the federal system, they ship you everywhere. You can be 3,000 miles from your house. So it was very important when I made the plea agreement to get to the prison near my house. And finally, after about 7 months, I was in Scottsdale, then they finally honored that. I had my lawyer pushing. But it was if you're gonna do time, it was the best place in the system.
What was your least favorite?
I had a lot of them. You know, they had me in, I guess Pennsylvania was a tough one. It was a level 6. It was a high-level institution. And they had me in a condemned area in the basement for a while, for a couple of months.
Is that like Supermax then?
It was Supermax, yeah. And when the feds were really squeezing me, they put me on what they call diesel therapy, where they ship you to all different prisons. You're in lockdown the whole time. You're chained and they just keep moving you around just to break you. It's very, very tough. It's the toughest part. And Oklahoma, El Reno was a sewer. I don't know how else to describe it. Terrible place. But I probably visited, I don't know, 10, 12, 13 prisons along the way. That many, yeah.
Why were they putting so much pressure on you to put you on diesel therapy?
They wanted me to cooperate. You know, they wanted me to, they told me you're a dead man anyway when I walked away from, you know, the words all over the street, you're going to get killed, you're not going to last, cooperate with us, we'll put you in the witness protection program, you know, we'll help you. I didn't want to do that. You know, Sean, as you know, you took your share of hits. I take people out there that don't know us, don't even know what they're talking about, just make up things because they want views, you know, they want people to watch them. But, you know, I spoke with the government, but only to try to get them to leave me alone. You know, I didn't get on to stand and testify against my former associates. I would never do that. And when push came to shove, because I wouldn't do it, they threw me back in a prison for almost 3 years. Well, 35 months. And they kept me in lockdown in solitary for 29 months. Just me, solitary confinement.
So, what was your routine in solitary?
God, you know what it is? When I look back, it was like I can't differentiate the days at a time. It's one long day. It's like the day that never ends. You know, but I saw a lot of guys not do well in that. You know, those lights go out at night. You hear a lot of moaning and groaning and crazy things. But, I mean, I survived it, you know. I got through it okay.
Exercise, reading?
Yeah, exercise. I mean, I lost like 20 pounds in there. You know, because what are you going to do? I didn't want to eat. You know, you lose your appetite. I ate cereal and bananas and cup of soup. That was it. But, you know, that's where my faith really became important to me. I was into my faith big time. My wife, you know, was sending me tons of books, and it turned out to be a good time for me, believe it or not.
Were you allowed visits in solitary? You're not allowed.
No, you get visits. You yeah, do. Yeah. It's a little bit more restrictive, but you do get visits, yeah.
Is it behind the plexiglass?
No. In the federal system, you go into it's a separate area, but you can get visits. No conjugal visits. In the federal system, none at all.
Have you had a conjugal visit?
I mean, believe me, I would have paid to have one, but no, we didn't get any.
Where were they possible? I know some countries still do them, but
in the state prisons they do.
Was it California had them?
California state, yes. In the state system, you can get it. The feds, no.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I would have done anything to have that, you know, because what it is, you go in an apartment for 2 days. Every hour you got to come out and say hello to the guards, you know, but who cares?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Would you say that your journey before prison, you met more dangerous people, or you met more dangerous people in prison?
Probably outside of prison, yeah.
Outside.
Yeah. I mean, when you're on the street, you know, you meet all sorts of, especially in my life, there's a lot of crazy guys, Sean, you know, the Roy DeMeos of the, I could talk about him, they're gone, but DeMeo, Greg Scarpa, you know, I don't want to say I was very close with him, but I was close with him because we were the same family. We were both captains, so we interacted a lot. Greg was a different kind of guy. You know, DeMeo, a couple of these guys were, you know, they're not right upstairs.
So being in a room with them, then what's the aura like?
Well, you don't feel anything. You know, people you say, were you scared of these guys? I had no reason to be scared of them. I mean, look, Sean, let me be honest. We were all capable of taking care of ourselves. I mean, if I knew somebody was going to hurt me, I'm going to hurt them first. I mean, it's very simple. I can do what they do. The difference is they like doing it a lot. This is what they did. This is how they solve problems. For me, if I had to do something, I'm going to do it. But it's not what I enjoyed. You know, it's a whole different mindset.
So with DeMeo then, murder machine, is that accurate or has it been...
In the Gemini Club, yeah, it was pretty accurate. He was, he was a different kind of guy.
Jen's not familiar, are you?
Gemini Club?
The Gemini Club was his social club.
Okay.
And, you know, a lot of murders took place in the Gemini Club, you know, orchestrated by him and his crew. So, and it had a reputation for that afterwards. You know, because Jennifer, at some point, all of these things are found out. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of informants on the street. The government has a lot of tools and weapons now in the United States to turn people. And so anything you do, you're in jeopardy of people knowing later on. Nothing is a secret anymore. That's the downfall and the demise of that life, no doubt.
Do you think it's past its peak then, and like the cartels have took over global dominance in?
I can't really speak for what's going on in Italy. I know they're very strong still in Italy. It's just the culture. It's part of the culture. I know Australia has a very strong group there. The United States, we still have a big presence, but the power structures that we had, the power bases like the unions, and a lot of the political contacts that we had have been taken away. So I give you an example. When I was on the street, there wasn't a day that went by when you didn't read in the newspaper some mob-related thing. Every day, every single day. Now I read the New York paper every day. Maybe every 6 months you'll see one story about what's going on the street. So they're smart, is that they went a lot more undercover. You know, they're not out there like the Gaddis were at one point. But they just don't have the power it had before. No.
What was it like growing up in New York in the early 50s, 60s?
You know, for me it was a different lifestyle. My dad was underboss of the Colombo family. He was very high profile. He was always, a major target of law enforcement. So we always had law enforcement around us all the time. My dad was getting arrested. You know, it was a lot of that. So I grew up in that environment where I hated the police. I hated government because I love my father and I watched these people harassing him and our family. That's how I viewed it. But it was a good time. You know, my dad, we used to go to the Copacabana, ringside seats. You know, the Copa was a famous nightclub. Saw everybody from Sinatra to Sammy Davis to Bobby Darin, you name it. You know, these were regulars, people that we knew. So that was wonderful, you know, I enjoyed that. Had a lot of perks being, you know, with my dad. And then the 60s were a tough era because that's when he went to trial 3 times and finally went off to prison, you know, after he got convicted. I used to get a lot of nonsense at school. Your dad's a mafia dad because he was always in the newspaper, so I fight. You know, stuff like that. But
I was gonna ask, at what age did you recognize that your dad was a boss?
Well, I mean, it early on I knew it because from the time I was 5 years old, my dad was in the limelight. But I didn't really understand it. And my dad didn't come into the house and say, let me explain what's going on. He never did that. He would keep everything outside. He wouldn't even talk about it in the house. So whatever I learned about him, I learned from the newspapers, I learned from other people, from observation, not from him directly. But I knew it early on, you know. And look, there were times when I got my driver's license, I was 16, 17, I would leave the house. We had law enforcement circling the house all the time, watching our every move, and they would follow me. And I'd bring them on a chase, you know, a wild chase. I remember one time, Sean, I brought them on a wild chase everywhere, right? I get back to the house, these two guys ring my doorbell, and they tell my father what I was doing. My dad he never really hit me, except for that day. Do you realize what you're messing with? Do you want to go to jail? Are you crazy? He was so upset with me. Don't you ever do that. You respect these guys. They're dangerous. He really gave it to me. So I never did that again. But, you know, I had a lot of incidents like that.
So how mobbed up was Sinatra?
You know, I want to make it clear. He wasn't controlled by the mob. He didn't have to pay them and, you know, he wasn't at the... But when a favor was needed, he did it, you know? So he knew that. And obviously with the whole Kennedy thing, he was a connection to the Kennedys for the guys in Chicago and around. There's no question about that. But I want to make it clear. He wasn't mobbed up in a sense where he had to pay money and tribute and all that. That wasn't the case. But look, I must have seen Frank 20, 30 times in my life, you know, in different places. There's a show on right now, I don't know if it's here yet, but it probably will be. It's called The Offer. And it's actually the prequel to The Godfather, the making of The Godfather. Very good show. If you get to watch it. It's on Paramount Plus. But it tells the whole story simultaneously of Joe Colombo and the Italian-American Civil Rights League and the influence that he had on The Godfather. And then it tells about how The Godfather got made. It's very well done. But that was my era. I was right in the middle of all of that, so to me it's even more interesting. And they're getting it somewhat right, a little bit, you know, they take dramatic liberty. But Sinatra was not portrayed well in this, you know, not portrayed well, because he did get help getting into the movie from here to eternity. Because you're young, but his career was in trouble. This movie kind of brought him back, and he needed a little help to get the part. And he got the help. But he didn't like that to be shown in the movie, that the mob guys had to help him get a part. He didn't like that, so he was upset about the movie. But he was a friend. Let's put it that way.
You did fund a film with mob money, didn't you?
Me? Yes. Yeah. But it was the best thing I ever did because I met my wife on that film. So.
Oh, brilliant.
I was filming it in Florida, and we had a lot of, you know, gas tax money at that time. So I actually funded the whole film with gas money.
What was the film about?
It was a breakdance movie. Yeah, I mean, Smokey, it was a lot of music, dance. It was a gang-related movie, but it was with music and dance. And it was Smokey Robinson and Leon Kennedy, two guys that brought me the script. And we made it in Florida, and I met a beautiful young girl who's now my wife for 37 years.
Congrats.
Yes, so it was the best money I ever spent.
Right? Yes.
How was the relationship with your family and the Kennedys established?
We didn't really have a relationship with our particular family, the Columbos. It was more out of Chicago. He had a relationship there. Joe Kennedy, you probably noticed, he was a bootlegger. He was heavily involved with the mob, even though, you know, it's not brought out there, but he was. And what happened, it was a very tight race when Kennedy was running for president with him and Nixon. And he needed Illinois and Chicago in order to win the race. And we delivered it to him. And in return, we were supposed to have access to the White House, and the heat from Cosa Nostra Mafia was supposed to be taken off. Just the opposite happened. Bobby Kennedy became Attorney General, and he went rampant on the mob. And that's where the problem came in. People were very upset, because you don't do that. You don't make a deal, and then, you know, we deliver the presidency to you. And then you go back on it. Not only do you go back on it, you come after us for it. So, listen, Sean, I will tell you this. There are classified documents about the Kennedy assassination that have never been released. They're classified. In my opinion, the reason they won't release them is because the truth is going to come out that the mob was able to get to a sitting president. And the CIA, the Secret Service, they don't want anybody to know that. So they keep it under wraps. But obviously that wasn't my time. I mean, I was 10 years old when he was killed. But I heard from everybody the story afterwards. My father was, he was right there during that time. All the people that I was involved with. And I asked different people at different times who told me the same exact story.
So do you believe he was killed by the mob?
100%. Okay. It's my belief.
Do you think the CIA had an interest in getting him out of the way, no matter who performed the assassination?
I think so. From what I heard, the CIA wasn't happy with him. And remember, the CIA came to us on more than one occasion to help them. When they wanted to assassinate Castro in Cuba, they came to us. Came to Johnny Roselli in Vegas to come to the guys in Chicago. We were setting that up. Lucky Luciano, during the war, in order to win his freedom, Meyer Lansky made the arrangement where we helped him at the docks, and we also helped him in Italy. You know, a great part of winning the war was because of what the mob helped the government. So, you know, they've come to us a couple of times. So it's not out of the question that they work with us. Mm-hmm. Trust me.
And why do you think Bobby Kennedy aggressively pursued the mafia? Had his old man had a stroke at that point, or was he not? Because wasn't the old man guiding the kids?
Yeah, I can't explain that, Sean. I don't know why he took that attitude. Because I don't know how old you are, Sean. Is this way before your time? All right, so you were young then, but I can't understand that. I really can't, because up to that point, J. Edgar Hoover, head of the FBI, would never even admit that it existed. And the reason for that is because we had dirt on him. He was a cross-dresser. He did some crazy things, you know, and we knew about it. And so we told him, you don't even admit it. You leave us alone, we'll leave you alone. And he did. He never even would admit it. It was Bobby Kennedy that started with Valachi and started to bring all of this about at the hearings, and then he went after Hoffa. So I don't know, I can't explain it. I think he just hated us, and nobody could control him. Even his brother, who was the president, couldn't control him.
So what are your thoughts on Saran Saran?
I had never heard that was mob related in any way. So I don't know what happened there. You know, maybe he just didn't like him.
We had a guy on that has researched it for decades, and he said, The wounds didn't match. You know, yeah, he got one off or whatever many shots Saran got off, but he had other wounds as well from other distances. So there's a lot of conspiracy theories.
Yeah, and our government, we try to keep things anything that's going to make them look bad, they don't want to come out, you know. But I mean, even the Kennedy killing, the way that happened, it shouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
You know, they should have been a lot more prepared for that. I mean, how do you let a, it's just common sense, how do you let a president ride in an open coach like that? You don't do that. That was number one mistake.
Do you have thoughts on the other killings from that era, like Malcolm X, Martin Luther King?
Again, not mob related, so I can't really speak to that. You know, I know we had nothing to do with that. At least I never heard we did.
Yeah.
So what was your father's relationship with Marilyn Monroe?
Well, I'll tell you how I found out what he told me anyway. I never knew anything about it, but I went to visit him after my mom died. And this was after 2012. And we were just talking, and it just came up. I said, Dad, you know, I want to ask you something. I don't want to insult you, because my dad had an ego, right? I says, in the 60s, the government came after you with a vengeance. I said, a vengeance. I said, you were important, but you weren't the main guy at that time. You know, you had Columbo. You had all the major guys around that were bosses. He was an under. I said, why did they come after you with a vengeance like this? I said, explain it. He said, all right, now that your mother passed away, I can tell you. He said, I wouldn't tell you when your mother was alive. I said, okay, great. He said, I was in the Stork Club, which is a famous club in New York. Frank Costello owned a piece of it. He was a boss. And one day, Marilyn Monroe happened to walk into the club. And so Frank said, do you want to meet Marilyn, to my dad? And he said, yeah. So they met. They had an affair. This is my dad's story, according to my dad. And then he tells me, Mike, you're not going to believe what happened. I said, what? He said, she told me this directly from my mom. I said, what? He said, she was having relations with Bobby Kennedy, and we know that to be true. Bobby and John both had her. And while they were doing their thing, she called out my name. And Bobby Kennedy got very insulted. He jumped on the phone with J. Edgar Hoover, and he said, I don't know who this Sonny Francis is, but put him in jail forever. And he says, I said, Dad. He said, Mike, I'm telling you, that's the truth. That's what happened. Because he said, I never had anything to do with Bobby Kennedy. Hoover was leaving me alone. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, I become the number one target. So I'm thinking about it. I said, Dad, you know, it makes sense. There could be some validity to that story. And that's what he stood by. So, makes sense.
What was Donald Trump's involvement in things over the years with the unions and getting things built?
You know, here's the thing. I've been asked this 100 times, you know, was Donald Trump mobbed up? And my answer was, every contractor in the city of New York had to deal with mob guys. We controlled all the unions. You want to get something built at a price, you had to come to us. Trump was no exception. So in that regard, yes, he dealt with us. I don't know him personally. I only met Donald once. I met him with Roy Cohn, who was his attorney, and I was doing some things with Roy. We met briefly in a club. Donald may not even remember that. But so I had no involvement. But did he deal with us? Of course he did. Everybody did. They had to. So, you know, I mean, Helmsley, all of it, you know, Gutterman, the guy that I was involved with, they all had to deal with us. So, but anything beyond that, no.
And did Roy Cohn try to rip you off?
Roy Cohn tried to rip me off, yes. When I got indicted, he came to me and he says, Michael, I can squash your indictment. There's no squashing federal indictments. So I said, okay, Roy, what do you want? He said, you give me $250,000. I said, $250,000, and the indictment's going to go away. He said, yeah. I said, Roy, I'm going to do better than that. I said, name your price, $500,000, $1 million, put it in escrow. I said, when the indictment is squashed, take it all. I said, because if I got to go to trial, it's going to cost me millions. So it's worth it. Well, we don't do it that way. I said, I know you don't, because you're going to rob me the other way. And that was the end of that.
So I've learned then it's all about your lawyer, you know, it goes a long way in court. I used a lawyer that the New Mexican Mafia referred to me, which helped me. He was like the lead lawyer for our case. Uh-huh. How did you keep Rudiani Giuliani at bay with your legal resources? Who were they back then?
Well, I'll tell you, I hired a guy by the name of John Jacobs, who had just left the U.S. Attorney's office, went into private practice. And I never knew I was going to be indicted in a Giuliani case. It was a different district. It was Southern District of New York. That was a total surprise to me, honestly. But I knew I was going to be indicted in the Eastern District, which is Brooklyn, because that was really my locale. And I hired him right out of the U.S. Attorney's Office because I figured he had information. They were investigating me for years. So I said, let me hire a guy that has knowledge. But then I get indicted with Giuliani first. So now I got him. And I told him, I set him down, I said, John, look, my father got railroaded. He was framed for a crime he didn't commit. I said his lawyer had a lot to do with him going to jail because he wouldn't put witnesses on the stand. He didn't hire an investigator. I said, I am very motivated myself to fight this case along with you. I said, so there's times you're going to tell me something. I may not agree with you, and there's times I will agree.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With you. And so I was very proactive in defending myself. I got my own investigators. I worked. My wife will tell you, I worked all day long just fighting, because that's what it takes to win a federal racketeering case. It's very hard to defend these cases, very hard. And so I beat the Giuliani case. Everybody, Giuliani told me, you're going to get 100 years if I convict you. He said, double what your father got.
How did that feel when he said that to you? Because that's the rest of your life, isn't it?
Yeah, but I got arrogant with him at that point because my attitude was different. When he said that to me, he says, he said it to my lawyer and me, he says, if Francis gets convicted, he's going to get double what his father got. My father got 50. He's going to get 100 years. So I looked at him, I say, hey, Rudy, bring it on. I beat you guys four times already because I beat four trials. Is let's go for round five, right? It was a stupid thing to do, but you don't want to attack.
How old were you at that point?
I was like 30.
And inwardly, you weren't thinking, shit, I've rolled the dice too many times.
No, yeah. No, I was a fighter.
Right, so, okay.
You know, I didn't like them so much. I'm fighting. You know, I was a fighter. I said, there's no way you're taking me. You're not taking me without a fight. So, and we fought him and we beat him.
You put a lot of people away, didn't you?
Huh?
Rudy,
my God, he put everybody away. Yeah, I mean, you got to give him the credit or the blame, whatever side you're on. But yeah, he was a guy, the racketeering laws had been on the books for 10 years, but they didn't use it. They didn't know how to use it. He figured it out. You got to give him credit for that. You know, I mean, he put a lot of guys away, no doubt.
Did you do an interview with him, with Patrick, or?
30 years later.
Yeah.
30 years later, a friend of mine who has a big radio show, Joe Pagliarulo, says, Mike, you know, I think I can get you and Rudy on the show. I said, you sure you want to do that, Joe? He said, yeah. So we go on together, and it was great because Rudy said, you know what? I've been watching you for 25 years. I believe you're sincere. He said, I believe it's a real transformation. He said, I'm watching you. And so things really calmed down. You want to hear something even more crazy? He wrote the foreword for my new book. Yes. And Jennifer, I was amazed at what a foreword he wrote.
Wow.
Yeah.
What did he write?
Huh?
What did he write?
Well, you got to read it. I'll give you a copy. I don't have the copy, but I'll give you a PDF of the book. You got to read what he wrote. I was like shocked. Because I said, man, I don't know what this guy's going to write. But no, he did a great job. He's, you know, believing that I was sincere and complete turnaround, but he also talked about all the guys he put away, you know.
Was he ever targeted for assassination for putting all those guys away?
Yes, yeah. You know, different than the mafia in Italy, we didn't go after law enforcement. Families and law enforcement, we don't touch. Giuliani was an exception. They were really talking about, I don't know if, and he knows this, I don't know if there was ever any real plan put in place, but they were talking about it. He was hated. He was hated.
Did you tell him that?
I told him that, yeah.
What was his reaction?
He said, I knew that, Michael.
Oh,
he said, well, I said, were you worried, Rudy? He said, no. He said, mm-hmm. Well, I had enough protection around me. But you know who Geraldo Rivera is?
Yeah.
He was targeted too. Everybody hated him. I told him that. He turned white. Yeah, I was on his television show with him. I said, Geraldo, there was only two guys that we really hated enough to kill. And he said, really, who? I said, Rudy. He said, oh, that makes sense. He said, who's the second one? I said, you. He said, me? He was shocked. They said, yeah, you, Geraldo, you. And that was, yeah, he didn't want to talk anymore after that.
You guys were okay with Montel Williams, though?
Yeah, Montel Williams. Everybody else, we got it. We understood.
So when did you start your YouTube channel?
Pandemic hits. I got 40 some odd dates, speaking dates that were postponed, obviously. First time in 20 some odd years, I'm not traveling. I don't know what to do, right? Actually, it was nice. Me and my wife, we got to spend time together. It was great. And then my team said, Mike, why don't you start a YouTube channel? I said, not into that, you know, social media and all that. No, let's do it. We got nothing. And that's how we started it. It was like an accident, you know? But we got very fortunate. It took off pretty well.
Have you been trolled?
Huh?
Have you been trolled?
I think so, yeah. I don't know all the terms. Believe me, I don't know this. My wife handles social media. My team handles it. I don't know all the terms. I'm very, I'm not very adept in that. Let's put it that way. But I found out one thing, and I'm sure you know this, Sean. Social media has exposed the lunacy in the world. People come out of nowhere saying the craziest things. You don't even know them. You don't know who they are. They make believe they're important and they know everything. They don't know anything. And other people listen to them and you can't control it. You know, it's part of the deal. If you're going to be on social media, it's going to happen.
What was your very first introduction to social media going back before YouTube?
I think, gosh, I don't even remember. Twitter or Facebook. I'm not sure. I don't even know how it got started.
Had you been long out of the joint at that point?
Oh, yeah. It happened way later on. I don't even know how I started it, honestly. I don't remember.
And then people started asking you to interview you to go on nerd channels. Is that
yes.
The momentum started to build from there?
The very 3 years ago, Patrick Bet-David came to me, and he had about 300,000 subs. I'll never forget. I didn't want to do it. He was chasing me. I don't know who he was. I had no idea, right? And he comes to my house. He was like 2 hours late. He comes, drives up in a Bentley. He's 2 hours late. We had an appointment later on. They set up in my house. And I'm saying, where's this guy? You know, what am I doing here with this stuff? I had like no interest in it.
The Patrick approaches you then. He shows up late. You do your thing. You're thinking, who is this guy? But then it goes ballistic online. You know. Did you read the comments and stuff? Did this like start to change your life? Because all this overwhelming amount of feedback and invitations to do things is coming in on the back of something that goes so viral?
I mean, I probably read some of the comments. I don't know. There's a lot of comments. But what happened was, and Patrick will admit, Patrick, by the way, is a dear friend of mine now. I love Patrick. We're doing things together. But it was that interview that made him decide to go with all these mob guys because it blew up. And then he started interviewing all the mob guys and became known for that, you know. I think probably because of the success of that, I started to get a lot. I mean, we get a call a day, no question about it. People from all over, you know, and they're trying to get you on. And my team now is selective, you know, with what we do, because you can't be everywhere. But, you know, it kind of opened my eyes to, wow, you get a lot of it. I will tell you this. And YouTube is not paying me for this, Google, but they should. It's the greatest platform in the world to be noticed. Everywhere I go now, even here, people coming up to me, I don't even know who they are. So many people have come up to me already, and it's all because of YouTube. In the airport, people bump into you. Hey, Michael, I know you. YouTube, best platform you can be on to become known, no doubt.
So in the beginning, now you mentioned the team, but in the beginning, were you trying to manage it all yourself?
Yeah.
You and your wife?
No, I had, because I wouldn't have done it. Sean, my wife will tell you, my team will tell you, they got to drag me in front of the camera to put content on.
Not very technical.
Oh, they drive me crazy. Oh, Michael, it's all about content, content, content.
Constant.
So that's it, constant. I mean, if it was up to them, they'd have me doing it every day. But I just can't. I can't do it. I just can't. Oh, my God.
It sucks the life out of you if you do too much, doesn't it? Who came up with the idea of Mob Movie Mondays?
I'll tell you what happened. BuzzFeed, I think. BuzzFeed asked me to review movies and a platform called The Insider. And then all of a sudden we got 10, 15, 20 million views. So I said, hey, this works. Let me do my own Mob Movie Monday, right? I think it was my wife that told me to do that. And she was right. Yeah.
So looking at, you know, the early interviews you did when you're talking about Gravano and Gotti, there was a bit of friction to begin with. And then, you know, there was, I saw what you did with Patrick. Then I saw him, you know, on with you, and he was screaming at you a bit, and you were trying to keep you cool, but you always keep you cool, but then you did in a video saying you felt that you lost your cool, you know. What's your relationship with Sammy? Let's go back to the very beginning. How did you first become aware of who Sammy was?
Well, I knew, you know, I mean, everybody knew the situation with him and Gotti, so, I mean, we knew it then. I didn't really know him on the street. You know, we didn't have any interaction. I had more interaction with John than I did I didn't have any with Sammy, actually. But I'm trying to think how it came about afterwards, how we finally connected afterwards. If he reached out to me or I reached out to him, somehow somebody brought us together.
Was it Patrick?
It wasn't Patrick initially, no. Patrick, it came later on. But I had met with him first, and I think a mutual friend brought us together. And he couldn't travel, he's on parole, so I went to Arizona to see him. We had a very nice meeting, we talked about different things, and that's when it came up. You know, Sammy, you and I are kind of the main guys in this. You know, maybe we'll do something together. And that's how the thing started to happen. And then we brought Patrick. Patrick actually came in afterwards and said, you know, maybe I can be the moderator. That's how it all came out. I don't know exactly, but that's how it all came about.
So it was all civilized on the phone when you met him.
Yeah.
But then it jumped off when it was on camera.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, Sammy and I have a different perception of things. You know, he thinks he's, in some ways, he's still mafia. I don't feel that way anymore, you know. And we had our differences of opinion on certain things, and it got a little bit heated, you know, but that's okay. But we resolved it afterwards, and we're probably going to do some things together in the future.
Is he quite hot-headed?
I mean, what you see is what you get with Sammy, you know.
Yeah.
There's no I mean, he has a fuse, you know. So do I. I just control it a little bit differently than him, you know. He's a little bit more, you know.
I think that's what makes it such good viewing, because you're known as the gentleman of the mafia, like you're just a class act. And he gets on and he's this live wire, and he can just explode at any second over anything.
Yes.
And then you've got those personalities together, and it's very good viewing, and I hope you guys do more together.
Yeah, well, it was interesting. You know, we have that sit-down was, it's 10 hours. We were there for 2 days.
Run us through that, because it looks so splendid, the setting and everything. You know, you fly in and you're staying at that location. And what was it like, the location?
It was beautiful. Yeah, I mean, we had a good time. Patrick did a great job. Patrick does things right. He did a great job putting it together. And the finished product is brilliant. I have to say it, the comments coming back from people that have seen it are terrific. And it's real. I mean, this wasn't staged. It wasn't scripted in any way. Patrick just fired questions, and we went at it, you know. He got a little bit more vivacious than I thought he would be, Sammy, you know. But, you know, the thing is, it's amazing, Sean. Things came back to me from 30 years ago. Normally at a sit-down, you have to be very respectful. You don't lose control. If we were at a real sit-down, he would have been, somebody would have told him to put him in check, because you don't do that. Not with two made guys, you don't do that. But you know, Patrick was not a made guy. He was a, you know, a newspaper guy, whatever you call it. But it was real. Yeah, it was real.
So how many days did it take to shoot 10 hours?
We shot for two and a half days, yeah.
And did he have to have like security on board?
We had security, yeah, yes. You know, it was quite secluded, yeah.
Can you talk the viewers through what a sit-down is?
What's that?
What a sit-down is.
A sit-down, anytime we had to resolve any kind of an issue among us, whether it be business, whether it be life or death for someone, it was always resolved in, hey, let's sit down. So that became the term. We having a sit down over this, because these were very, it could be very important meetings. Somebody's life could be at stake. And when you had two made guys, guys that took the oath sitting down, there were rules. You had to be very respectful. For instance, if Sammy was sitting across from me and he was lying through his teeth and I called him a liar, I lose. Can't do that. Can't be disrespectful. I had to figure out a way to expose him so that people would understand the guy who was in charge, you know, the boss, this guy's not telling the truth, and then things come in my favor. You had to be very cagey. And the old-timers, they were very cagey. They tried to trap you into making a mistake at the sit-down so you automatically lose. It's like in the United States when you're taking a driving test, right? You hit the curb as you're parking, automatic failure. So it's the same. You could be perfect driver, hit the curb a little bit, automatic failure. Boom, take another test. Same with a sit-down. You had to be very cagey in how you handle these things.
We call that a game cat and mouse here.
Yeah, it was kind of cat and mouse, yeah. So even if you were 100% right, you could lose. You know, then there's politics involved. So let's say the guy on the other side of the table was closer to the boss than you were. Well, automatically, in his mind, he wants that guy to win. So you have to make such a presentation that he can't do that. You know, and I'm like, you know, going in, oh, I'm sitting with this guy. He's so close to the boss. I gotta really think about how I'm going to win this, you know. So it's very, very technical. And then it could be a matter of life and death. I hate to say it, but, you know, somebody gets in trouble. What's going to happen with this guy? And we're going to talk about it. And, you know, if it's that serious, then serious consequences.
Have you got any sit-downs that you particularly remember that you could describe?
Yeah, I mean, sit-downs with Gotti, and yeah, there's a lot of them that I do remember because, Sean, it was like a way of life for me. Mm. When you become as high-profile as me, and, you know, I enjoyed some success in that life, people, you're sitting down all the time. And I had a big crew, and they're always getting in trouble. Always getting in trouble. You got to sit down, bail them out, you know. Because we had I had a couple hundred guys under me. And they're in trouble here and there and there. You get a call, hey, Mike, this guy, okay, we go sit down, and wrong or right, we figure it out. So, and some of them were real serious. And then unfortunately, you know, those guys that made mistakes, and you got to try to bail them out or save them, and it gets touchy.
What happens if the mistake is irretrievable?
Is there what?
What happens if the mistake is too much? You can't bail them out?
Sometimes you just can't. You just can't. I mean, if it's that wrong and that's blatant a violation, what could you do?
Have you ever got into a sit-down fearing for your life?
One time. It wasn't so much the sit-down, it was getting to the sit-down. Yeah, you know, one of the horrors of that life, really horrors, is that you make a mistake, you don't, you know, your best friend walks you into a room, you don't walk out again. And unfortunately, it's a part of that life that's terrible, really. And, you know, I spent over 20 years in that life, so obviously I know the experience. But that happened to me one night. You know, I was walked into a room, I didn't know if I was going to walk out again, because some things were, you know, money. You know, I'm making a lot of money, and guys are getting a little nervous about it, and I had a big crew, so they really put me on the spot. Basically, my boss wanted to make me understand that he's still the boss. So, but it was a very touchy situation. So I was nervous walking in, I'll be honest with you. You know, when you think you're going to go, it's scary. And but it worked out. I'm here, obviously, you know. But, yeah, it's tough. Tough part of the life.
So that was don't outshine the master.
Huh?
Don't outshine the master.
No. Mm-mm. You don't do that. Never.
Yeah.
Because in that life, they, what do they feel? Take over. You're trying to get their spot. You know, you don't do that. Because, you know, one thing, one fallacy about what people think is that from after in the early part of Cosa Nostra, guys were killing each other, families were going to war with each other. That stopped. After Luciano put everything together, that stopped. Whenever there's a war, it's always a civil war. It's internal. Now, some of the other families can have a little bit of influence on that, but they don't get involved physically in it. It's internal. So whenever it's a power thing, that's it. Hey, you're the boss. I want to be the boss. Boom. Families go to war. The two within themselves. It's never a war among families. That doesn't happen.
It's almost like jails are microcosm of that, because where I was, it was like the gangs, whites, blacks, Mexicans, if they had a war, we'd get locked down, drugs business gets stopped. So if a white guy and a black guy got a beef, the shot callers just send them in a cell under the stairs, squash the beef, then they're having a smoke afterwards, then the drug business doesn't get stopped.
Yeah.
It's always over the top spot. Yeah. Like when Persico, my boss, went to jail, he put somebody else in charge. Persico's going to jail forever. He's never coming home. So the guy in charge now wants to be the real boss. My boss, Persico, puts somebody else as his acting boss. Said, until my son, his son and me came in at the same times, we were the same age. He actually baptized my son, John. We were gumbadas, as they call it in Italian. So Persico, my boss, Junior, tells Vicarina, who was a captain at the time, you're going to be acting boss until my son comes home from prison, and then he's taking the spot. Okay, that's the way you arrange it. Junior goes to jail forever. Arena's running the family. I don't want to give it up, he says. I want to be the boss. So Alley Boy was coming home, the son. He said, I'm the boss. You're not the boss. He gets some men on his side. Junior still has men loyal to him. They go to war. When Junior found out about it, he took the first shot. He went after Arena and missed him. And then the war started. Yeah.
What do you think about the internal coup against Castellano?
Listen, you know, bottom line on this is that Gotti knew he was in trouble. They were dealing drugs and some other things that were going on. He knew he was in trouble. And he made the first move, which was smart. That's what he had to do. Otherwise, you're waiting there to get killed. Doesn't make sense, right? So you have to act first.
Aren't you supposed to get it sanctioned, though, from the five families?
You could, but you don't have to. Yeah, I mean, it's your deal now. The other family guys were not happy with what Gotti did. It wasn't popular.
Was it the chin in particular?
He was not happy, yeah. They called him the chin because whenever anybody would talk about him, they'd go like this, so... He didn't give himself the name because he didn't want you to, you weren't allowed to mention his name. If he found out you mentioned his name, he might kill you because he don't want no heat from the government. And he played like he was crazy. But people ask me, Mike, was he really crazy? I said, look, to play crazy for 30 years, you got to be a little crazy, right? But when I met with him, he was smart as a fox.
Is it true that he wandered the streets in his nightgown?
Yeah, oh yeah. I walked it with him. Yes.
You didn't have to wear a nightgown.
No. Hair all messy, no shave, his beard, right? And a house coat. Yeah, slippers. Walk up and down Houston Street, which is a busy street in New York, you know, and we're just talking, back and forth.
Wow.
Yeah, you couldn't even mention his name. He wouldn't let you. But he was really the power in New York.
So was that the main response from the Paul Castellano hit? Was from the chin, was it, sir?
Yeah, well, he went after Gotti after that, yeah. He didn't like the fact that Gotti made that move. You know, I mean, bosses take it as an insult. You come after another boss without discussing it with us. That's not right, you know?
And do you think Gotti's downfall then was, you know, he was talking to the media and he was out putting himself in public and stuff?
Gotti's downfall, you know, there's a book that was just written by a guy by the name of Gleason. He was a prosecutor that prosecuted Gotti, then he became a federal judge, and now he wrote a book. And he tells the whole story. He said the reason Gotti went down is because he thumbed his nose in everybody's face. You can't do that. The government's got more power, more resources, and more time than anybody else. If you thumb your nose in their face, like, I am who I am, you're nobody, they're gonna get you. And Gotti motivated the whole government to come after him. So eventually you're gonna go down. There's no question. They're going to get you.
Complete opposite of your father.
My father didn't do that. He tried to maintain a low profile. He was always respectful to law. But if the Kennedy thing is true, he didn't have a chance. My dad was framed on the bank robbery case. He was not a bank robber. He didn't order those bank robberies. I know from my own personal investigation, we spoke to all the witnesses. They told us straight out, we framed your father. But we needed a big name, your father. They wanted your father. And we framed him. It was very easy. They robbed all the banks. They really robbed them. And all they did is say, Sonny told me to do it. That was it. And a few guys in between, you see, here's the problem, Sean. You probably know this experience. Some guys that my dad had around him were dealing with these bank robbers. So they were able to make the connection through these guys. My father got upset when he found out because these four guys were all drug addicts. They're all junkies. Mm-hmm. From the time I was a kid, my father put it in my head. He hated drugs, hated. He would make up stories about how the guys got themselves in trouble with drugs to scare me. I never, till this very day, I've never even smoked pot.
So did he get convicted purely on witness statements?
Purely on statements. Nothing else.
America, conspiracy
in the federal state, yes. Yeah. You don't even need corroboration. One witness could get you convicted. I could walk out of here today and say, Jennifer tried to kill me. I tell the government, if I'm believable, you're going to jail.
Please don't.
I won't. I promise.
They arrested the people in my case and they were getting them to sign Exhibit A, people who didn't even know me, saying that they worked for me. And they were coming out of court. I was going in court. They were coming out and they were showing me, look what they did. They just tried to do.
I don't believe you can do that in the UK.
Absolutely. In the federal state, yeah. In the federal system, yes.
Mm. How many years did your father serve?
40.
40?
40 out of the 50.
Holy shit.
Yeah. You said in a previous interview about The Sopranos being quite fictional, nothing like what went on. Is there any other movies out there that you believe is totally off key?
Well, let me tell you the few that are on point. The best movie, in my opinion, the most accurate, scene by scene by scene, was the 1996 HBO movie, Gotti, with Armand Desante and with Anthony Quinn. Brilliant movie, very well done, and very accurate. Because the movie, the script really came out of a lot of the surveillance reports and the tapes. It was very accurate, and Armand Desante, and they were brilliant. I watched that movie 20 times. It was so good. Godfather is in a different category, obviously. Brilliant movie. Godfather 1 and 2, brilliant. Fictional, a lot of fiction in that, but just brilliantly done. There's nothing bad you could say about any of it. Goodfellas, pretty accurate, yes. Donnie Brasco, pretty accurate. Bronx Tale, accurately portrayed by Chaz. He did a brilliant job as the guy. I thought he portrayed a mob guy brilliantly. So they were good. Casino, pretty accurate. After that, there's so many out there that I won't even watch. Because to me, authenticity means everything, you know? Like, they're doing a television series based upon my life now. It's been in development 2 years. I worked, probably put 100 hours in with the writer. And the company is Kennedy Marshall, major company. And they just casted the main guy to play Michael. I can't tell you who it is because they'll get mad at me. But they just casted Michael. Now they're casting Sonny, my father. And then they'll go into production soon. But the writer, who's a brilliant writer, he's an A-list writer, he's done a lot of stuff, he's a California guy. So I said to him, his name is Ron Shelton. I said, Ron, you're brilliant, but you've never been to Brooklyn. So your dialogue is not going to be right. I said, so you and I have to have a deal. You give me the script and let me clean up the dialogue to make it Brooklyn. He welcomed that. He said, great, Michael. The structure, the character development, the storyline, because I felt brilliant. But the dialogue, I had to do it. Because if a guy's supposed to be from Brooklyn, he's talking like California, it ain't going to work, right? But I'm very, very happy with the end product right now. So
you must watch a lot of stuff and just think it's pure cheeseball.
Yeah, a lot of stuff he watches. Just, you know, Sopranos, look, I thought, what's his name, Tony Soprano, I thought he was terrific. But really, the story in The Sopranos, if you really look at it, what is it? It's about the family. That's what's interesting. the dynamic with him and his mother reminded me so much of me and my mom. My mom was tough. You know, his wife, the kids, that's the real story there. It's not what the guys are doing, you know. A lot of that is good, and some of it is silly. But any of these stories, any of these movies, Peaky Blinders, oh my God, what a brilliant scene. Sean, brilliant. People were trying to get me to watch that for, I turned it on. I couldn't understand them talking. I said, I can't watch this, right? This was about a year ago. Then my brother-in-law comes to me and says, Mike, you got to watch it. I said, I can't understand the way these guys are talking. He said, use the subtitles.
I was going to say, did you put the subtitles on? Yes.
Once I started that, I couldn't stop. Brilliant. Oh, my God.
Are the accents that hard?
Huh?
Are the accents that different?
Yes.
Birmingham.
For me, yes.
For an American, Birmingham. Yeah.
Is it really quite different?
Last time I was here, I did 12 or 13 dates. We go to the Isle of Man. I did a date there, right? It was great. Some guy comes up to me afterwards from Liverpool.
I was about to say, Liverpool's going to be the hardest.
Jennifer, he's talking to me for 2 hours. I didn't understand one word he was saying. I just kept shaking my head. Yeah, I must have been responding well because he wouldn't stop talking. I could not understand a word. That's why I told Kaz in the tour, I said, Kaz, you better have, if we're going to do a Q&A, you better figure this out because I can't understand.
I'm going to be translating for you.
Oh, you?
Yeah,
you're hosting, right?
Yeah, terrific.
Yeah.
No offense to Scousers. We are coming to Liverpool in August. If you want to get a ticket, it's going to be in the description box. I will translate for Michael.
Please, I need help.
We'll bring Wild Woman as well.
Because a little bit I can't hear sometimes. I have to read the lips. And if I don't get it, I don't know what you're talking about.
What about his accent?
I'm getting it.
Because I'm 20 minutes from Liverpool, but when I went to America, they couldn't understand me, but it was a broader, more Manchester kind of northern accent. So I had to change to speak like this so that they could understand me in America when I was starting out. But when
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Our defender came over. We had Wild Man and Wild Woman. So Wild Man's from my town, but Wild Woman's from Liverpool, so she's a mad Scouser. Uh-huh. And they were, you know, they couldn't understand her. The lawyer was saying, I need to get a translator and all this. Couldn't understand. It's called Scouse. It's called Scouse. What they speak in Liverpool. Scouse.
It's on.
Yeah, yeah.
The other, last week, I was in Cleveland. I was doing a date, and my wife was, my wife wasn't with me. My brother-in-law was with me. And I'm on the phone with Kaz, our host for the tour, and there was these fellas from from India that have a production company that want to do a deal, right? So I'm in the car, and we're driving to the airport, and the guy's talking for a half an hour. My hand to God, I didn't understand one word, not one word, but I'm saying, okay, that sounds good, and he's laying out 5 points of things he wants to do. We hang up, I said, Kaz, I don't know what the heck he was talking about. I said, I hope I said yes to the right things. It's hard.
A bit of trouble, though.
Yeah, it's hard. And you actually speak proper English. Yes. We speak American, but I don't know.
Thank you.
I still say things like, I'm going to go to the grocery store.
Yeah.
What was it you called it? We went shopping the other day. And you called it a shopping centre.
The mall.
The mall.
Yeah, malls here, huh?
They don't call them malls.
They don't call them malls.
No.
I think there's one in Bristol.
Shopping centre.
And
the freeway is the motorway.
Yes.
I asked Kaz,
I said, do we have a freeway here? Because we're going all these side streets.
And are you driving?
Yeah, he was right. No, me?
Yeah.
No.
The road thing, is that a bit of a head?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Like when I went to get in the car, when he picked me up, I went in the driver's side, you know? Yeah, it's different. It's different. People drive crazy here, but it's not as bad as Israel. I have a dear friend, I know him 30 years, he's Israeli. We go to Israel, we're doing something there. I can't believe it. They roll down the window, cursing each other out. They knock off the side view mirror on the car. My wife was in the car with me and my daughter one day. Next day we had to go someplace. She said, I'm taking a bus, I'm not getting back in the car. I said, come on, it's Moshe. She said, I don't care. You know, she wouldn't get back in the car. I don't blame her.
Jane got arrested in Israel, but we'll tell you that story later.
Yeah.
Out of all mafia movies then, and the roles that these guys are playing, who's your favorite roles and actors?
Okay, I actually have three. Number one, Armand DeSante. Well, actually, I'm going to say four. Armand DeSante and Anthony Quinn in the Gotti movie. Brilliant. Armand DeSante, and they can play anything. They're just brilliant. He became a good friend of mine. So Armand DeSante, Anthony Quinn, Joe Pesci.
Oh, yeah.
Dynamic, lights up the screen. Was brilliant. I didn't mention The Irishman. Was very well done. Fictional. Sheahan did not kill Hoffa. 100% wrong. Everybody knows that. But he was brilliant as Russ Bufalino, somebody that I knew fairly well. Played a total different from every other mob role that he played. He was always a crazy guy. Bufalino was very calm, same way. He played him brilliant. So it's Armand DeSante, Anthony Quinn, Joe Pesci, and in the movie, Donnie Brasco. Pacino, that was his most brilliant role as far as I was concerned. He captured, Lefty, I knew him well, he captured him and he played that role brilliantly. So those four are my top guys.
Do you think that the murder of Whitey was intentional then, if the feds like put him in an area where he could get accessed?
You know, Sean, the feds make mistakes. They really do. Look, Henry Hill was in separation from everybody. They put him in Terminal Island when I was there with 10 other mob guys. It was an accident.
After he'd already rolled over.
Yeah. I mean, the word on Henry was shoot to kill. And you see him, kill him. And they put him in there. It was an accident because he was on separation. And the feds, they put you on separation from people they don't want you with. It was a total mistake. So it could have been a mistake with Whitey Bulger. They make those mistakes. Was it intentional? I tend to think not. Because I know that they screw up a lot. They let guys out that are supposed to be doing 100 years. They let them walk out of a courtroom. It doesn't happen all the time, but it does happen.
How often does it happen where they're working with FBI like that?
Who's that?
Snitches.
People in the lifestyle who are murdering other people, and they're working with the authorities to wipe out the competition?
You know what, Sean?
That's what he was doing, wasn't
he? Unfortunately, it happens more than we would like to know. I mean, guys are working. When we found out Greg Scarpa was dealing with the government for 20 years, I got nervous because I did things with Greg. I said, my gosh. Another guy, Willie Boy Johnson, who was a Gotti guy, but I was friendly with him. I was Shylock of Money with him, working with the feds for 20 years. You know, when you hear this, it's like, so it's probably happening more than we know, until we know, because it always comes out later on. That's why the street is a tough life, man. You don't know who to trust. You don't know what's going on, you know? Tough.
One of the books I read inside was Man of Honor, Joe Bonanno Sr., who ended up living in the Sin Vacas neighborhood where I was living before I got arrested. Shaking your head, what? Not a man of honor?
Ridiculous book. There's no reason to write a book like that. And Giuliani will tell you that's what motivated him to go after the mafia. He read the book, Giuliani's Italian. He got so insulted by the book, and he said that Joe Bonanno laid out the entire commission case in that book. He laid it out to him. He told him, he gave him the blueprint on how to go after the guys. The book betrayed the life in a big way. That's what motivated Giuliani to do what he do. He said to me, Michael, that gave me the blueprint to go after the bosses. And he was right, because he got them all. What was your reason for writing? It was so stupid.
Did he do that after he got run out of New York?
Out of New York. He writes the book. I mean, look, Sean, you can't take the mafia and try to make them like they're the nice people. You know, you can't do. You're gonna insult Italian Americans, first of all. So many people get insulted by the book because the mafia is the mafia. Cosa Nostra is Cosa Nostra. You know, you can't turn it around and make it some benevolent organization. And that's what he tried to do. It was ridiculous. He insulted people.
So when you were making all those millions, what was your typical day? I'm like visualizing an extravagant lifestyle, cars, meals, finest restaurants.
You want to lay low, don't you? You don't want to be flash like Gotti.
Yeah.
You know, again, because I was so active, I was very aggressive. I was a worker. So I was working a lot, you know, because when I became a captain in that life, I had a lot of guys under me. I had I had a lot of legitimate businesses. I had car agencies, I had a production company, I had restaurants that I had. So, you know, I was maintaining control of all of this. And then, of course, the gas business, which was my major operation, took a lot of time and effort. So I was working constantly. But along the way, I was enjoying myself for the most part. I mean, I had a jet plane, I had a helicopter, I had houses in three states, I had, you know, boats, I had a lot of stuff. So we would make time for leisure. And look, I had a good time with my crew. We had some guys who were very close. And I was always around guys, and we had a good time, you know, along with everything else that we were doing. But, you know, did it lead to my downfall? Yeah.
And the police took everything.
Well, they took a lot, yeah. They didn't take everything. You know, one of the reasons I took a plea, you know, of course, because I met my wife, I fell in love with her, and Sean, I realized this life is, it's over. Especially somebody like me who had a target in his back from day one because of my dad. And then when I started to make my own way, boom, I mean, it became even more intense. You know, I don't know if you know this, but they had a 14-agency task force made up of state, local, and federal agencies. It was a Michael Francis task force, where their sole job, they would meet in the courthouse of Uniondale, Long Island, and their sole job was to take me down and put me away forever. Now, I didn't know this until later on, but I said to myself, what shot do I have here? I don't care how many cases I beat, how much money I got to keep spending, they're going to get me. There's no doubt. And they're going to put me away for a long time. That's when I realized, after I beat the Giuliani case, I had leverage. I said, okay. They lost five times with me. They called Gotti the Teflon Don. They lost five cases against me. Now, it's not as publicized, but five times, they really wanted a conviction. Giuliani thought he had me. And boom, I'm acquitted. So now the next case comes up. I said, okay, I got leverage. I met this woman. I want to marry her. I'm in love. I want to get out of this life because eventually I'm going to jail forever. How can I use this leverage? That's when I told my lawyer, let's take a plea. Because here's what happened to me, Sean. You'll understand this. My partner in the gas business turned informant, and Giuliani brought him in to testify in that case, and we destroyed him on the witness stand. So now I destroyed the gas case major witness, destroyed him. So now the government is worried. Hey, he beat this guy. He's the major witness against him. Maybe he'll lose again. So I said, let's offer a plea. Okay, great. 25 years and a $100 million fine. I said, listen, I don't care if they ask for $300 million. I ain't paying them anyway. Let them have a judgment against me. I didn't care. My lawyer was smarter than me then because he said, no, Michael, because they're going to haunt you for the rest of your life. You're going to make money in your life. You don't need that. So he talked me out of that. I said, 25 years, no good. I said, 5 years. I knew they weren't going to give me five. We settled on 10. We still had parole back then. Now in the system, no parole. But back then, you had parole. I said, all right, I'll do five. I can handle that. My wife will handle that. A marriage will be set up. And when I did it, I said, look, I don't want my wife to work while I'm in jail. I said, so I need money. Part of the money, I got to be able to keep. Okay, they gave me that. House, I got, I'm going to keep that. I gave them my plane. I gave them all the other stuff. I said, but my personal stuff to take care of my wife, there's no negotiation. So they allowed me to have that. So she had money while I was away. She had a house over her head, you know, she had a car and all. I don't have to worry about that. I don't want to worry. She said, this is enough for 5 years. We'll be okay.
Well, you got with your sunglasses.
I did something very similar then, because when they arrested Sammy's crew, mm-hmm. all 57 rolled. But when they arrested mine, only four rolled.
57 rolled in Sammy's crew?
All of them. We had over 100 of mine, only four rolled. So we're like, we've got plea bargaining power now. We fought the case for 26 months.
Right.
And at the end, we just gave them everything, agreed to be banned from America for life. And
are you banned now for
America? Yeah. So I got 9.5. And because we had this loophole lawyer, I had to do just under 6 on it as a first-time non-violent drug offender who was not a US citizen.
Did your wife at the time get to keep anyone?
How much?
No.
How much time did you actually do?
It's just under 6.
Just under 6.
Yeah.
In America?
In Arizona, yeah.
That's where
I met Gerard, was in Towers Jail originally.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so you did all the time in that Arizona.
In Arizona.
What was the name of that jail again? In Black.
Sheriff Joe Arpaio's Maricopa County
Jail
State. System.
You did state?
All state.
Oh,
all state.
Okay.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that's what happened. So I was able to negotiate on that part. you know? And then my plan was, there was no cooperation, man. Then my plan was, okay, I get out of jail, I move to California, I have parole. I use that as an excuse because you meet with people on parole, they give you separation. You meet with somebody, you're violated. I use that as an excuse not to meet with the guys in New York. Maybe after 10, 12 years, they'll forget about me. But then it became public that I was walking away, and then all hell broke loose in my life. But it was didn't work out the way I planned it. But
some people say you can never quite walk away from it. It could catch up on you at any time. Do you still think there's an element of that in your life?
Yes.
Do you have to live accordingly?
Do you look over your shoulder?
It's not looking over my shoulder. I always look over my shoulder. It's instinct. I'm walking down the street, I hear a footstep, I'm looking back, you know, when I'm with my wife. I mean, and I'm always looking around to see who's around me. That's instinctual, it's never changed. Even when I was on the street, right up until now, so just part of who I am. But, you know, I don't worry about it. I don't have bodyguards all over me, unless I'm going to a place where, because look, you don't thumb your nose in somebody's face. That's the problem, you know, people are, really? You want to be away? Okay, you want... Then you get them angry. I don't want to do that, you know, but I don't bother them. I'm not hurting anybody. I don't want to hurt anybody. I don't talk bad about anybody. Why? You know, it don't make sense. So I don't live in fear. But look, Sean knows this. He's a high-profile guy. I'm a high-profile guy. It's like anything else. When you're high-profile, anything. You get... You know, yesterday in New York, some lunatic went into church and shot people. Another guy in Buffalo, New York, killed 10 or 20 people in a shopping mall. People, you don't know what they're going to do. So you always have to think about it, but you can't live in fear.
In your dealings with other mafias then, like Russians or Colombians, was the etiquette different than within the Italian mafia?
I had Russian partners, best partners I had up until that point. Got along, great. They don't have a structure like we had. They were more family, close-knit that way. And whoever was making the most money became the leader. That's how we viewed it, at least that's how I saw it. But they didn't have a structured organization like we had.
You said they didn't fear the system either.
No.
So they were ruthless.
Yeah, one of the guys did time in a Russian prison. He said, Mike, you think I'm worried about the government here? I said, okay, good. Yeah, no, they were, you know, they were very good partners. We made a tremendous amount of money together, and, you know, we cut a good deal between us, and we both honored it, and that was it.
Because I've written a lot about Escobar and the Colombians, and we're about to do the book for the son of the Cali cartel. Mm-hmm. Did you have any dealings with the Colombians?
No, only in prison. I met with a couple of guys. But really, Sean, I wasn't interested in drugs. I didn't want to be involved in it. It was two things. It was a moral issue for me, because my sister died of an overdose of drugs. My brother was a drug addict for over 25 years, and they put us through hell. I mean, I can't even begin to tell you. My sister, who I loved, my baby sister, you know, when I would have to go looking for her, and I'd find her in these flea-bit places with guys sticking something in her arm. You want to know the truth? I did more damage to people as a result of my sister than I did in my whole time in that life. Because, you know, you see your baby sister, you love her, and somebody's abusing her, you go nuts. I don't care if you're in the mob or not. You go crazy. Anybody would. But it happened so often with her. And my brother, too. You know, my brother would have been dead 100 times if it wasn't for me and my dad. Because of the things he got involved in, drug-wise, you know. Terry, we had to save him so many times.
How old was your sister when she died?
27.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, she was young, a beautiful girl, and, you know, just those drugs are just terrible. Yeah.
One of my favorite interviews is with you and Mike Tyson and the chemistry. How did your relationship with Mike Tyson start?
Through another guy that knows him for 20-some-odd years. He used to spar. He knows him way back to the Gus Amato days. And we became friends, and then he introduced me to Mike. Well, actually, no, I met Mike first. Yeah, I met Mike when he got in touch with me to go on his show, on Hot Boxing or whatever it is. And he reached out to me, I don't know how. I had met him once or twice before that, just, you know, hello and goodbye. Because I was always interested in fights. The fight game was, I loved it. And then a mutual friend brought us together even closer. Funny story, I asked Mike, we were all out to dinner, me, my wife, his wife, and I said to Mike, I said, I can't get into this MMA stuff. I was always a fighter. I love boxing. I said, do you like it? He looked at me, he says, Mike, two cockroaches could be on the table together fighting, and I'm interested. He said, I don't care what kind of fighting it is. Just like that, it made me laugh. But he's a good guy. Mike, very sincere and very honest. He has no filter. Whatever's in his head is in his mouth. But we became pretty tight. He's a good guy. I like him a lot. We're going to do some things together, actually.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. On the scale of 1 to 10, how charismatic is he?
Very. Yeah, he's, yeah, very, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. He's very animated when he talks. He'll laugh like crazy if something's funny to him. Yeah, he's a good guy. I could say this as a fellow guy from Brooklyn. I'm proud of Mike, the way he's turned himself around. I really am. I think he got a bum rap with that rape charge that he was on. I mean, I know the particulars of it. It was a bum rap. But, you know, and he's very sincere, very honest. I mean, he'd have been dead if he didn't get involved in boxing. And Custy Amato, who he loved, if Custy Amato was alive, he would have never gotten in trouble because he looked up to him like he was God. And I don't mean that, you know, disrespectfully to the God, but you know, he was just a troubled soul. He had to get over a lot of things, but, you know, he would have been undefeated forever. I mean it. Because even, you know, you shake his hand and you know there's power there. Trust me. Yeah.
We're good friends with Big Joe Egan. Shout out to Joe. We're publishing his book, Toughest White Man on the Planet, if you want to watch it. You've got a relationship with Joe as well, don't you?
Yes, yes. Yeah, we sat down. Loved the interview with Joe. He was, as a matter of fact, Joe is the guy who introduced me to Kaz to put this whole tour together, you know? So I spoke to Mike and I mentioned Joe to him, and before I said a word, he said, toughest white man on the planet. He repeated it again. But you know what, when Joe tells you the story, he said, when he went to first spar with him, yeah, he seen all these guys getting knocked out. I said to him, Joe, how did it feel? He says, Mike, he says, he said, it was like electric shock when he hit me in the chest. It went right through my whole body. Yeah, he's such a good guy, Joe.
If you want to watch our podcast with Big Joe Egan, it's coming out soon, and it's going to be called From Mike Tyson to Michael Francis. We're almost out of time here, Michael. You've been very gracious with us today.
So what is the tour about? Sorry to interrupt.
You know, it's about my life. We're going to have some great hosts, one of them sitting right next to you.
Jen might be coming along.
Okay, yeah, Jen, that'd be great. And we're going to talk, you know, Sean, people are interested in my life, right? I tell you this quickly before we wrap up. I'm in Singapore. Now, I never realized this. When you're part of the life, this is your life. You live it, and that's it, day to day. When I got out of the life and I started speaking, I never realized how intriguing this life is to everybody all over the world, all over the world. I'm in Singapore, speak in front of 1,800 people. My host says to me, Mike, we promised a Q&A. He said, but don't worry about it. Well, I ain't worried. He said, but Singaporeans don't ask questions. They're very reserved, very proper. He said, we're going to put a shill in. Maybe you get one or two questions. I said, great. We'll go home early. Jennifer, 2 hours. Now I'm looking around. I said, are they going to stop this? But how informed they were. They asked questions about Gotti and the movies and everything. Jimmy Hoffa, where's he buried? I said, wow, all over the world, the same thing. So here, I know you don't have a mafia presence here, really. You know, you don't, thank God. But I feel comfortable to talk about some things I've never spoken before in the States. You know, I'm a little careful with what I do. But they're going to hear about my life. They're going to hear about the mob life like they've never heard it before. They're going to know the truth about it, ins and outs and that. Certain stories that I haven't told before I'm going to talk about. And then we're going to do a Q&A. And I always say, ask me anything you want. I've been asked everything under the sun. And if I don't want to answer, I don't answer. I know how to do it, right? But I answer questions. We're going to have a good time. The way the host is setting it up, I'm excited. They're all mostly all dinner shows. All, you know, very well done, I would say. So we're going to have a great time. Great time. I'm looking forward to it. It starts July 2nd at the Grosvenor. It's going to be the big opening night, red carpet. They're doing a whole bit. I got a great host, you know, on this. He's really, really doing the right thing. And then we're going to go around the country. We're going to Scotland, I think Wales also. And we may even hop over to Ireland, which is not part of the UK, right? Ireland is not,
not
or it
anymore.
Is?
Well, oh.
North and South.
North and South.
All right. Well, I don't know which part we're going to, but we're going there. And then just have a great time.
While you're in Europe, are you going to be visiting Italy?
Absolutely. I got to tell you, I love, my wife and I, we love Italy. We spent a week at Capri a couple of years ago. It was like being in paradise, you know? When I first went to Italy, I had everybody telling me, Mike, I'm going to give you a restaurant to go to. And I said, leave me alone. I said, I want to pick my own spots. I don't want to hear anything. So every restaurant we went to was great. We just picked a spot. Everyone was terrific. So yeah, you can't miss, right? But we, yeah, we're going to spend some time in Italy. We may move around a little bit while we're here, yeah.
So if you've enjoyed this podcast as much as us, come to the shows. The links for all the venues, the dates, how you can get them are going to be in the description box. Please go over and join the subscribers marching to a million on Michael's YouTube channel. He's at 800 and something thousand. I checked it this morning. Blasted past me, and he's well on his way to a million. Shout out to Sammy the Bull as well. He's doing amazing. I love listening to his stories. Hope we can do some collaborations with him. And all of the social links, everything will be down there in the description box, as will all of Jen's links as well, if you want to check out her stuff on Instagram. And let us know in the comments what you thought about this. And we look forward to seeing some of you at the show. And check his books out as well. Oh, huge thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Absolutely brilliant.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.